Hey, 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 it's Faye OJ. Welcome to The Motion Champions, an extra special season of The Motion, a debate podcast where two guests with conflicting opinions engage in an intellectual and fierce tug of war to sway my vote to their side of the motion. Win the motion once, fair enough, but win the motion twice against a fellow winner of The Motion. Now that is a champion. So join us as we determine who the true champions are and to have your emotions set in motion in a way they never have been before. Peaceful protests don't work. Honestly, I was wondering whether protests at all work. Like, as I started researching, like, I guess today's episode will be comparing and contrasting the effectiveness of peaceful protests against other forms. And arguing that peaceful protests don't work, we have Chitty.
Hello. I'm ready to go. Let's go.
She is the amazing co-host and author of It's a Continent podcast. And the book is out now as of the 7th of July under the same name, so make sure you check that out as well. On the other side, we have Tash, who is a corporate lawyer and content creator.
Hey guys, nice to meet you or greet you.
As an icebreaker, I wanted to know, linked to our topic, what you think the most trivial thing that you would protest for is, just to give some inspiration. I don't know if you guys are fans of Wagamama, but they took the Chahal off the menu, and they're just constantly always making menu changes that don't need to happen. They literally find out like the best thing on their menu and then they just take it off, and I really don't understand, and I would literally go out and protest against like Wagamama menu changes.
I feel you. I think our protest against people who pretend they love going to the office, and of course everyone likes to go, no one likes going to the office, stop lying please.
You know what, linked to that, I'd protest unnecessary work drinks. Like, I'm sorry, like, we're in the it's not that deep, it's time to go home, I want to put on my Netflix, I don't need to not eat until 9 p.m. because I'm drinking, thanks.
As a special twist this season, whoever gives the best icebreaker answer gets an I'ma let you finish, or as you might recognise it,
I'm really happy for you, I'll let you finish.
And that is an opportunity to interrupt once and once only during the first section of the debate. This episode goes to Tash. Just because I am a semi-recovering, not really trying to recover alcoholic, love a good work drink, it's free drinks, like, I'm not going to say no to that. I actually think that's the only reason why I like going into the office, so it kind of goes hand in hand. With all that out the way, it's time for the opening statements, a rough summary of what you think and why.
A riot is the language of the unheard. You might be surprised to know that the guy who said this was Martin Luther King Jr., who seems to now be the peaceful protest poster child. But actually, he was actually about that life. This sentiment drives home the idea that actually peaceful protests are only effective within circumstances that are conditional. We do need to have protests that aren't peaceful in order to shift the current conditions. So another quote from Kwame Ture is that in order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none. If the state or whatever structure you're protesting against doesn't care, doesn't have any sympathy, then a couple of kumbayas is not going to change their mind.
I don't have any quotes. I would say that the debate is framed in absolute terms. Peaceful protests do not work. We have to understand that a peaceful protest is something that doesn't operate in a vacuum and is combined with, it could be embargo, it could be disorder as well. Framing it in a much wider context, it allows us to see that a peaceful protest is more than just achieving one absolute political objective. Alongside this as well, looking at a protest as something which people can partake in, you can see peaceful protest as something which allows people to actually get up, march, sit down, talk, converse, debate, etc. And something which is non-violent allows people to do that.
Love both your opening statements. As always, just gonna dig a little bit deeper, stir the pot, and get you on your feet with some questions. Tash, you kind of almost read my mind, because my first question that I want you both to answer, surprise, surprise, is what defines a peaceful protest?
In terms of peaceful, that's something that's not disruptive. I would think that a protest that is not peaceful is a protest that is disruptive. It may include what some people may describe as looting. It may also describe, you know, what Extinction Rebellion was doing, for example. So causing disruption to transport networks, kind of irritating people, but actually making people more familiar about the cause. So I didn't know anything about Interlate Britain. I didn't know about how deep the insulation crisis was until they, you know, came on the scene. And now cost of living's going up. I'm wishing I had better insulation. So maybe they did have a point after all.
For me, a peaceful protest is, it goes beyond march in the street. It goes beyond picketing. It goes beyond boycotting. It could be conversations. It could be challenging a curriculum. It could be a teacher sitting down in a classroom and saying, actually, our curriculum says X, but let's discuss further. Let's go on Wikipedia. So seeing it in such wide terms, a protest could be as little as a conversation to as big as a massive march.
Similarly, but in a different kind of vein, what does a successful protest look like?
A protest is successful if it allows that person who's protesting to express their view, their frustration, to express their status and allow people to understand. And it is also successful when the recipient can at least hear and understand. They may not empathize, they may not sympathize, but if they can get on a journey or start their journey of understanding, that is successful.
I would say a successful protest is when there's like a shift in some kind of policy that would mean that what the person has been protesting about, something happens. So then there's a change as a result of the cause that they've been fighting for, essentially.
Now that we've got those kind of definitions out of the way and added some context to this debate, I want to hit you with some numbers, Chinny. You know, men lie, women lie, but numbers do not. And when it comes to stats, peaceful protests do seem to be more effective. I think between 1990 and 2006, about 300 protests were studied. And I think even more so were up to 2014. And they both found that non-violent protests tend to be twice as effective, attracting like times 11 the number of participants. I think Tash mentioned in his opening statement how much wider. I can't fight, for example, like you're not going to find me at a violent protest, even if I might want to, because I can't fight. Whereas a peaceful protest, you don't really have those entry requirements. Apart from like the number and the turnout, peaceful protests averaged on about 3 years, whereas violent protests averaged on about 9.
I would say that you would normally have the peaceful protest kind of towards the end. But what has started that shift in policy? It's that initial push. In Accra, in the capital city of Ghana, 1948, at first it was supposed to be a peaceful protest against the way that the Ghanaian soldiers were treated following World War II. What was supposed to be a peaceful protest where they would kind of queue up and sign petitions, the Brits reacted by the police actually shooting into the crowd. This then aggravated the crowd, and then it meant that violence ensued. The Brits obviously shook at that point, and then that eventually culminated in Ghana being the first sort of black African country to gain independence. This is an example of when the Ghanaians were like, okay, let's just like do this like peacefully, respectfully. But the person who you were actually like protesting against didn't have respect for you. So there had to be that escalation.
I'll let you finish.
When people are protesting, they tend to be depressed and they're not able to control the narrative. So if you can't control the narrative, if you can't shape how things are framed, you have to be extremely cute with how you market yourself and how you market your campaign. A lot of occasions, especially in recent history, when you do see true violence, vandalism, death, injuries, the discourse of violence tends to hijack the true message. The Black Lives Matter movement recently, like 2020, 2021, rather than policymakers properly discussing the experience of Black cultures and Black individuals, violence was used as a scapegoat to allow policymakers and decision makers divert the true efforts or true conversation to what needed to happen. Another example could also be like the Mark Duggan initial march in Tottenham 2011 and how that went to protests and riot. And again, rather than speaking about police brutality, racial profiling, and how we actually, I don't know, police and apprehend individuals, the violence and the vandalism was used as a scapegoat to, again, divert conversations away from this. I think most people appreciate passion, etc. But once it hijacks a true conversation, that's when you have an issue.
No, I appreciate the point. But I think that not everybody has access to be able to have those conversations. And as we say, with the violence being the tool, that sometimes that's the only form of protest that some people have. They're not able to have conversations with policymakers or politicians. And also, most of the time, these politicians, like here in the UK, let's be real, they don't want to do anything about it. So they're just going to scapegoat anyway. Sometimes, no matter how the picture is framed, they're always going to, there'd always be something else that they'll pin it on.
I think it's really interesting, kind of the language that we use. For example, I don't know if you saw this video about circa 2020 of this black woman, and she's like, you're lucky that what black people are looking for is equality and not revenge. I had actually never seen the full video, and she gives a lot of background into how obviously the 400 years, but then even in the 50 years after that, where black people were able to build their own communities like Rosewood and Tulsa, they were still burned down. Like, this is post-slavery. If you look at colonialism as well, the oppressor speaks the language of violence. Like, that is literally what they're fluent in. And I think it's really interesting that when you kind of want to combat that or defend yourself, it becomes, you know, a narrative losing control, where the narrative has been controlled by violence, and then someone's basically expected to bring a knife to a gunfight. We're not allowed to speak back in the language that it was built on.
Implicitly in your question slash statement is that maybe a lack of regard for human lives as well. So I understand that, yes, the oppressors speak the language of aggression, like the language of the West and the US, is the US Army and all the naval bases. Of course, we understand that. In challenging that through violent or non-peaceful protests, we're asking individuals, fathers, brothers, mothers, uncles, grandparents, etc., to potentially risk their lives, risk their livelihoods, risk some of their limbs, their mental health. So alongside trying to challenge, combat, etc., is that worth the expense of like human lives as well? That's one question we can't overlook. Yes, we want to make change. Yes, sometimes you do have to be forceful for it, but like, my brother shouldn't die, my dad shouldn't die. I think that's one thing to answer as well. And secondly, even if we do believe that violence is the only language those in power understand, those in power are extremely fluent in that language. They have so many tools, they have so many weapons. That conversation is almost like a PhD student having a debate with a year six student, and it doesn't work. And we've seen examples with war all the time, where a few nations, when they have fought back with violence, like example Haiti, for instance, we can look at their economy a lot. We can look at how the world responds when they have massive natural disasters. So when the smaller country, when David does respond to Goliath in the real world, it has massive repercussions. It costs lives, it costs livelihoods, it costs economies and growth.
I think that's a great answer. As you were speaking, I was just thinking of Kyle Rittenhouse. I hope I didn't say his name right, because I don't care about him. And how it kind of unfortunately does detract from the main thing because of the way the systems are set up. You have a white 17-year-old go to a protest, shoot two people dead, and he is walking free. Like, no matter what your intention was before, I think the moment when that happens, it does kind of make you think. Chinny, I'm interested in what you have to say back to that.
Another example that I'll bring up is the Boston Tea Party. European on European violence, as it were. They're still lauded as heroes if they respond to violence with violence. The way the Boston Tea Party came about was that a group of colonists threw, like, basically damaged properties into the Boston Harbour, and that was because the British Parliament wanted to lower taxes. When the people in America, which used to be a British colony, destroyed property, they were like, oh, okay, oh, that's fine, oh, let's walk away from that. Which is why I say that it goes back to the fact that if they have sympathy or they have a conscience, then they'll listen. But if at the root of it they don't care, then why would they care if you then speak their language?
I do empathise, but I do think that public perception is really important when you're trying to get more people onto your side. When you see, for example, that picture of the black woman like standing still, and the fact that you're nodding because it comes to your head like so quickly, right? All the police, and then there's this one black woman, and she's not resisting, she's not doing anything. And as I say that, I'm like, ugh, respectability politics, hate it. But at the end of the day, the amount of pictures that come from these protests, and if you look at the ones of people looting versus the ones where you have police, like, for example, at the Sarah Everard protest, fighting against people that look so innocent, I think it's so much easier to someone that doesn't really have as much foot in the fight to sympathize with that kind of image of violence against a peaceful party versus violence v violence. It's like an eye for an eye makes the world blind. In the literal sense, you cannot actually see in a visual sense who the kind of bad guys are, even though, like, we know. It's harder to see from like a public perspective. And I appreciate everything you're saying, and the point you made about, you know, my father shouldn't die, my brother shouldn't die, I found it very emotive. But I think when we're looking at whether what actually works, protests in general tend to be very like reactionary, whether they're violent, whether they're non-violent. After every example of like, say, these big marches, whether it was like the Women's March or the March for Our Lives, it's like almost instantly afterwards, a legislation is passed that is in the opposite direction or the opposite belief system in which the protest was for. So, for example, in the Women's March, 2 days later, Trump signed the abortion bill. So I think, you know, it's easy for us to kind of see these big demonstrations and think that change can actually happen. But when it comes to the legislators, the bills, and like as Chinny spoke about what a successful protest looks like, the change isn't happening. I think it's one of those things that if you do not hear, you will feel. And I think it's very cute to see protests and stuff like that, but it ends up dying down. That kind of long-term urgency isn't really there with like the marches.
I feel like in a capitalist landscape, capitalism, oppression and violence are all interlinked, and money, I think the implicit question is violence then the answer? And I would say no, there's other forms of peaceful protest which equally hurt people as much, and that could be to their pockets. So a good example is with the Russian war on Ukraine and the West. Yes, they definitely are supplying arms, which is an example of a violent action. Another thing which people think are really effective are also sanctions. And Chelsea Football Club, for instance, having to go up for sale. The examples you spoke of were the Women's March, I don't know how long it was, a couple of days, a couple of weeks, etc., was peaceful. But my next question is, well, if they marched for 6 months, a year, if they decided, all women, 50% of the US population decided not to trade in a certain way, I would like to think that legislation would be more effective in their favour. So to answer your question directly, there's other ways of peaceful protesting which can bring about that answer.
I think that leads me on to my question to you, Chinny, in the sense that, as I said, both protests, violent, non-violent, tend to be reactionary. However, I think with violence, it just makes it so much easier to lose focus earlier. And I think if we look at how much train drivers are trained, paid even, these people are striking and striking and striking because it's working. Train strikes literally affect the UK. You can really, really feel it. There's no violence involved. It's just like, you need me to drive your train. I'm going to show you what life looks like when I can't drive your train. So that's actually making impact and, you know, staying very close to the root of what the protests have started because of. And I think the reasons why strikes and like unions and stuff like this work is because they don't just strike when the iron's hot, they stay strategically striking. It has that kind of long-term urgency, and I think it's that is the reason why they see successes.
I'm pretty sure that it must have been either last summer or something like that, Priti Patel put in a legislation that would limit disruptive protesting, or perhaps if you were shouting too loudly at a protest, then they have the right to shut it down. If the government were not threatened by those sort of action, I don't think they would have taken up such a strong stance. And also, it's quite difficult because if you say, oh, I'm going to boycott this brand, then you find out that the parent brand owns like everything, then you can't really do much about that. And that's supposed to be a peaceful protest, but that doesn't really work as such. The suffragettes were a group that we all remember now. And I mean, suffragists also existed, but no one really talks about them. They were like the quiet lot. They were the peaceful protest route. They wanted to do things in a way that was still legal. However, this didn't actually include the working class women. Whereas the suffragettes, with their kind of anyone could take part, it was a bit more open. This lady threw herself in front of a horse. Like
Emily Pankhurst.
Yes. You know, she threw herself in front of a horse and she died. You know what I mean? Like, these people are actually so passionate, but it doesn't really matter to them if they die for these kind of causes. I think we live in a very different era now where we're like, huh, like these kind of protests, we just post on social media. Like, no one's actually about that. Like, people went to the Black Lives Matter to post on Instagram. Do you know what I mean? Whereas then, like, people actually paid for these things with their lives because they were that passionate about it.
I think for every suffragist, I think there were like 500,000 suffragists and like 10,000 suffragettes, but you definitely want to check that. But there was like significantly less suffragettes than suffragists. And I think it kind of works in both your favours, because I guess in terms of accessibility, it's easier to be a suffragist. But then I guess if you look at the number and the impact that suffragettes were able to make with a smaller number, then it makes you think of kind of like the impact. And as you said, that I will never forget Emily Pankhurst's name. And I think I was 14 when I first learned about her. As you go into the main debate, the areas of conflict I'm having, I feel like we're doomed from the get. Time and time again, peaceful protesters are labelled as looters or as violent. If you already think I'm violent and I can choose peace or choose violence, then I feel like violence is going to be more effective, then I might as well be violent. But then I'm also like, the distraction and how it detracts from the cause as well. You are officially free to directly rebuttal each other. It's time for the main debate.
one point initially was the idea that individuals don't have access to capital or finances to maybe do, I don't know, boycott things. If we also look at the value of our labour, the value of our preference and our footfall, we have power and capital to actually still impact people financially and economically. Let's say I'm, for argument's sake, a feminist or something like that, and I'm trying to debate or challenge my husband or my partner on gender roles in the household, for instance, purely by refusing to conform to gender norms, or, I don't know, refusing to cook food, or refusing to look after my child, or, and lying down and doing absolutely nothing, there's value in that labour. There's capital which can be extracted from that labour, which will surely or ideally impact the partner I'm living with. And if you think about that on a larger scale as well, many people who may not have access to tangible cash, if they look at the value in their labour, or they look at the value they give to people they work for, simply by stopping is a way of being able to access more financial means of protest, which is still peaceful.
So that only really works if you're unionised, though. But like, what I meant by saying accessible is that like, not everyone, in terms of how those with lower capital are less likely to be able to talk to those policymakers to be able to have access to that, as opposed to have access to boycott. I guess the boycott point I was making was that we're such a consumer-driven society that if you tried to boycott Cadbury's, for example, after watching the documentary on like the cocoa farms, you then have to boycott Kraft. Do you see what I mean? Like everything is so interlaced that it's really impossible to just boycott one brand anymore. And then also like if people did do that, no one is, again, because of the way our society is set up, people can't just stop working like that unless they are part of unions. And that's why people are so envious of train drivers, because the government has worked to get rid of and dismantle unions, so that it's quite difficult to do that these days.
I think to counteract that point, and I think you've almost played into it, you said that massive organizations and companies are scared of unions, and there's a reason why there's less unions in the UK and less unions in the quote developed world, the Western world, because they're so effective. Looking at history, looking at the present state of play of unions, that's another great example as to why peaceful protest is so successful and why massive organisations and political parties have tried to suppress them and limit the numbers of them.
I would say that peaceful protests only work if the institutions that you are protesting against essentially has a conscience, cares about your cause. If they do, then fine. And often it takes a long time to get to that point. And you do have to do those demonstrations, the civil rights movement that wasn't achieved. These people that appeared peaceful on the surface, yes, they got to that point of being peaceful. The number of uprisings that happened in apartheid South Africa to get to where the country is today and to get to Nelson Mandela being freed, they couldn't have achieved that solely through peace.
You're suggesting that the trigger event for change to happen is some form of violence, is the riot of individuals. But then the next question is it the riot slash the fire in the belly which makes legislation, or is it the economic, financial, geopolitical fallout from these protests? So for instance, like apartheid South Africa, alongside the violence, there were like scores of sanctions directed towards South Africa. I'd argue that was extremely impactful, and it's impactful to the point where when you're looking at the human rights or the experience of people in a sovereign nation, it's very difficult to be violent. It's very difficult to actually step in and invade another country's sovereignty. That's when you have the more non-violent forms of challenging the system, protesting, etc. That's when it's so effective. I argue that it's the step afterwards whereby actually we can't always be violent. You can't always be violent because it can lead to a massive war. It will lead to more deaths. It will lead to people arguing, etc., and there being no end.
I think that's a super interesting point, but I'm just thinking about, like, I guess there's obviously different forms of protest. There's, like, wars, etc. Does the average person have that power to make a kind of economic sanction that, say, a president of a Western country is going to feel?
I would say it does. I'll give you an example. Let's say I work for a major investment bank, and I'm a director at this investment bank, and I'm about to close a deal with a massive, massive Russian company. However, me as an individual on a moral level disagree with the war in Ukraine. I say no as a director from this investment bank. I'm not doing a transaction with this company. That could be £20 billion. It could be £30 billion. If every single individual director at a load of investment banks all make the same decision, that could be 200 billion, pounds worth of money or commerce stop straight away from one individual action.
They ain't gonna do that though.
The average person isn't an investment banker.
The average person works with that director. The average person is in the same team, is in the same floor, has the conversations. One simple act for one individual can definitely have a knock-on effect.
I just want to get your say on like these two quotes. The first one is, we have touched the limit of public demonstration. Nothing but militant action is left to us now. And that was from a suffragette. And then I think it's a Malcolm, and it's willing to participate in the democratic process, but if the democratic process doesn't work, if we can't get equal rights, human rights, through the democratic process, then willing to appeal to the bullet. And I think that's from one of his most popular speeches, like the ballot or the bullet. Those kind of quotes is what makes me emphasize mostly to Chinny's side, because I feel like we've seen so many people try the good way, try to engage the way that we're told to. And I have so much sympathy for people who do this and it's just not working. And I appreciate that, yes, everyone does have some sort of agency and some sort of say in the society. But I also think it's interesting that the example that you use is a director at an investment bank, which I would argue doesn't represent the general masses.
You spoke about two individuals who expressed these opinions in the 20th century. Did they achieve their goal? Yes and no. The issue still persists. Malcolm X was about in the 60s, yeah. He's saying the ballot, the bullet, shoot back, whatever, defend, whatever. But like, the issue still persists. So I think if you look at it from a very literal sense, could you argue that no, his stance didn't work and his stance wasn't very successful? Could you argue that? This is more of a rhetorical question because I think it's such a politically charged answer for me to say anything too much.
With Malcolm X, though, he was met with violence himself, right? And they tried to silence him. They also tried to silence Martin Luther King Jr. But their legacies live on. I don't think they were successful in that. And also at that point, like, black people didn't have basic human rights, like, and they were trying everything. Nobody was listening. I don't see how that point could have been gotten to if we didn't go through the fire, as it were. Yeah, I was thinking that too. Similar point with the suffragettes as well. Like, they wouldn't have gotten to that point if not for widening the access to other women and being quote unquote violent. Like, it just had to be done. Whilst I would say, yeah, peaceful protests are part of the process, it can't happen without the previous language of the unheard being said. Western governments only really listen once there's something going on, there's something at stake, reputation's at stake. We've all seen the picture of Jeremy Corbyn being dragged away from a protest, carrying the, you know, the Stop Apartheid picket sign. But if there was not any uprising or anything like that, would they have just assumed, oh, they must be fine with it and just not sanctioned?
In short, I actually don't disagree with you, but me agreeing with you, I think, ties into the debate and helps answer the question like very directly. Your suggestion was that if it wasn't for that initial spark of violence, nothing would have happened. But I'm assuming you're also saying that with that spark of violence, with that aggression, there are other acts of peaceful protest, i.e. Jeremy Corbyn, which also helped along the way. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the way that he was dragged by the police, we think that it was a peaceful... They reacted with violence to Jeremy Corbyn, so I don't think they would have classed it as a peaceful protest if he was dragged away like that.
I would say the response from the oppressors or from the police officers was violent. I would say that Jeremy Corbyn's stance was non-violent and was actually peaceful. And if you take in everything collectively, i.e. marches, riots, people dying, Jeremy Corbyn, the street picketing, it did work. So peaceful protests, in the example you provided, do work. They are necessary in the whole grand scheme of achieving a goal. And the example you literally provided allowed me to answer that without me having to open my mouth.
But I don't understand. I said that it wouldn't have happened if not for the violence. So if there's no violence, then what is there?
They need each other. That's what you're both saying. It's basically a chicken and the egg situation. It's so interesting that in these examples that we have, there's always examples of both. There's Malcolm and there's MLK. There's suffragists and suffragettes. But I think you'll find that a lot of people did kind of sit in the middle. They were both. However, where I would say that, like, I'm less leaning to Chash's side is that if you're going to look at a peaceful protest, purely peaceful protest, we will be waiting till kingdom come. Similarly, I don't think a purely violent protest would be able to, you know, make much way. The issue is that I think with a peace, it gets to that point where it's like, you're not hearing us.
I feel like we're not answering the question. do peaceful protests work? I'm saying peaceful protests do work.
With violence.
No, I'm saying they work. And the question is, what do we mean by work? Getting legislative change. Is it expressing frustration? Is it educating? Is it disseminating information? Or is it to be used as a tool with violent protest? If you're looking at it in a wider context, yes, they definitely do work because it could be a tool or could be the main thing. None of the arguments or questions which have been posed have excluded the presence of a peaceful protest in any form.
But the conversation happens because of that event, so it's linked to that. I mean, they're not going to be protesting, like they're saying, hey, we're ready to talk, and they're still going to be protesting. They're like, okay, we can drop our stuff now. Now we can have a conversation because that's the aim of the violent protest.
Yeah, because you can't fight forever. Like
the way you're framing it, people upset, people are frustrated. They went straight to war. There was no protest. There was no debate. There was nothing in between. There's always something in between. And if there's anything in between or alongside, it argues that peaceful protests do work because they're part of the vehicle to get to the end. Do they work? Not do they work as the main vehicle. So do they work? Yes. Do they work as a main vehicle? Maybe.
Do they work as a main vehicle in contrast to violent protests being the main vehicle?
I would say no, Haiti being an example, looking at the economy and how they are now, unfortunately. Even though I love, empathise, sympathise with their plight, their fight, I would say no.
Okay, so are you throwing the towel in?
No, sorry. Nothing works as the absolute vehicle. You need both. To say that one component to this vehicle doesn't work is fundamentally incorrect. Because we've never seen anything over the course of history, politically, whatever, as just being one thing.
It's an interesting interpretation of the question. If I phrase this as, do violent protests work? How would that change your stance, both of you?
I would agree, because at the end of the day, it's the spark. Like, if you don't have the start gun, you're not going to run.
I would also agree, because it's part of the vehicle going forward.
Let's draw this to an end, because I feel like we're just going to be driving in this vehicle. I know I was coming back on Tash more, and I think that's just because I'm actually like a proponent of peace. One of my favorite musicals is Les Miserables. Spoiler alert, sorry. The boys that kind of ran the barricade, like pretty much all but one died. But the thing is, they actually did overthrow the king, like in real life. And I think people kind of reference the French a lot because that's something that they've been doing. They've like been rioting. And it's like, we're sitting here in London, maybe like an hour, 2 hour train away, and we're just allowing things to happen. We're allowing our Prime Minister to be an absolute party animal. Literally, him and Nick Cannon, like, going back and forth. How many children can we have? While I would hope that peace would be the answer, I think it's so hard when we're dealing with who we're dealing with. However, I'm going to have to come to a conclusion on who convinced me the most today. Earlier on, Tash won that I would let you finish. And the rule is, if it's convincing enough, you steal 10 seconds from your opponent's closing statement. And I think it was the point about the sanctity of life. So, Tash, you have 40 seconds. Chinny, you have 20 seconds. It's time for the closing statements.
The debate ties down to where you want to draw that line. And for me and for many peaceful protesters, that human lives, well-being, physical, social, mental, whatever. And whenever that is crossed, cannot justify anything. And the second point to understand is that things do not operate in a vacuum. You need to look at things wider. And even as for a short-term goal, one small smidgen, the peaceful protest can work.
Sometimes, you know, when people say people died for our freedom, unfortunately, human loss has to happen in order for progression to happen in our society. The French, yeah, they got rid of their monarchy. How? Through violence.
It's really, really tough. I actually hate death. I don't want people to die. I hate the fact that I've come to this conclusion, but I just feel like I don't think I've been convinced enough that, like, for example, I think before, I had the impression that, yeah, peaceful protests do work, but they'll just take time and time and time. And I was like, you know, as I said, who has that time? But I'm also thinking of the amount of lives that are lost right now, even without protesting, due to people being oppressed, whether it's like mental health, physical health, like we don't actually live in a fair world. And I think if there needs to be like a kind of, I don't really like the word sacrifice, but like maybe like a short-term loss to prevent more losses down the line, then surely that is actually causing the least amount of harm to the most amount of people. And so for that reason, Chinny, you have won. The conversation does not stop here. Follow us on Instagram at TheMotion_, tweet us your thoughts at TheMotionPod_, send us an email, themotionpodcast@gmail.com, and listen to our radio show every Sunday live on Wizard Radio from 5 p.m. Be blessed, stay safe, and have a wonderful week.